Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
Today's guest is my friend Josh Crawford from the Pegasus Institute, a Kentucky-based policy research think tank. They've got powerful stuff out there, and they have really got some interesting information on their website about ways that we can make policing better in America and maybe fix some of the issues that we have. We had a long conversation that encompassed the Breonna Taylor situation, unrest in the city of Louisville, as well as the Supreme Court. We also talked about weightlifting and getting into physical shape. So have fun listening to this conversation. Oh, and we talked about work ethic. So check out this conversation I had with my friend Josh Crawford from the Pegasus Institute. Yeah, so your dad's a painting contractor?
Yep.
Like, so did you work for him when you were a teenager?
Oh, yeah. And then I would get farmed out to other guys, too. So, like, I roofed for a summer. I did that kind of stuff. And his whole thing was that he wanted me to experience what that was like so that I stayed in school and did all that kind of stuff because it's not easy work.
Did it work? Like, did it help? Did it? Because obviously you're a brilliant guy and obviously you've been successful. So do you attribute any of that actually having to do manual labor to your success?
You know, I don't think at the time I consciously thought like, man, I don't ever want to do this again, so let's stay in school. But I think one of the things that it definitely did was it taught me what hard work was like. And the thing that I would tell people in law school all the time, because my law school classmates would complain all the time about how much work we had and how difficult things were. And I always thought, like, if I called my dad and said, like, you just don't understand, it's so hard, the crap I would get for doing that. It's like, oh, is the building air conditioning? Do you sit down? Do you just have to look? It's like, you know. So I think that definitely had an impact for sure.
What was the most formative work ethic developing situation you encountered growing up?
Oh, I remember this verbatim. I tell people this all the time. So my dad still works out four times a week, lifts four times a week.
Right.
And I had a Pop Warner football practice that got rained out. And like everybody's parents had to come pick him up because it was like thunderstorming or something.
Yeah.
And my dad was on the way to the gym. So, you know, like I didn't have a cell phone at the time. So, you know, coaches called my mom. She called my dad and he picked me up on the way, but he didn't drop me off at home on the way to the gym. He brought me to the gym with him.
Right.
And it was this realization of like, okay, I don't get the afternoon off because practice is canceled. I'm going to spend this time in the gym. And I was, you know, 10 years old or something like that.
Right.
That for me turned into a lot of time in the gym and a national bench press record in high school and all that kind of stuff. But the major lesson there, aside from the sort of fitness aspect of it, was that, you know, never take that moment for granted and spend that time, you know, trying to better yourself in some other way. And so that was the big one for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you didn't get your day off, and that taught you that, well, day offs are for losers, right?
Right, exactly. Absolutely.
So go ahead. I'm sorry.
I would say it did a couple of things, right? It taught me that, but it also, for me personally, ignited a love of lifting weights that
right.
I sort of never looked back on.
I didn't realize you had, it was a lifting championship? Which one did you say that was?
Yeah, so in high school, I broke a national bench press record.
Dude.
Ended up finishing second overall in the country, between the three powerlifting lifts, so squat, bench, and deadlift, but actually broke the national bench press record.
What was the record at the time, and how much did you do?
I can't recall what the record was, but I did just over 400 pounds, because all of that stuff is in kilograms, so it ended up being like 403 pounds or something like that.
Right. What can you bench press now?
So I could probably, if I take enough pre-workout and have the right music on, I could probably bench 450 right now.
More than the record at the time?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So I continued to compete into college, and then through sort of a number of injuries and a refocus on academics, decided to put that on the back shelf.
Right.
And then got real into lifting again while I was in law school, because it was a great release for the sort of rigmarole and stress of law school. And then for basically this entire quarantine period since the gyms have reopened, I've started to really kind of take it seriously again and see sort of how far I can push myself.
That's awesome.
And I'm benching like 375 right now consistently for reps, and so if I haven't maxed out in a while, but I could probably push 450 right now if I really tried.
Yeah, so I'm proud of you. I mean, I don't think before too long you'll probably be able to hit my numbers. You know, I mean, you're getting pretty close.
Look, Leland, you are the inspiration here, and so you know, just the closer I can get. I don't know that I'll ever hit it, but the closer I can get, the better I'll feel.
Yeah. So you're right about the release. Like I'm taking some fighting classes right now,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it's nothing extraordinary, and it's fascinating and it's fun, and it's like I don't know. It's just a big release, and it gives you a little sense of a confidence. You know, like you can handle yourself, you can defend yourself, you can do certain mm-hmm. things. And it is a relief. What's your diet like when you're lifting?
So I'm actually I tell people this all the time. If you hit your quarantine 15 or your COVID-19 or whatever, you've done this time period wrong, right? So I'm actually down about 19 pounds right now.
Nice.
I have been sort of consistently trying to lose weight, and I'm on target to get to a goal weight in the early springtime. I do sort of a moderate carb, mm-hmm. high protein, high fat.
Mm-hmm.
It probably isn't accurate to say super low carb, but it is certainly lower than what a lot of the USDA guidelines are and things like that.
Well, you're pushing a lot of energy, so you need a little bit more. So that
exactly.
sounds right. I mean, that sounds, with given what you're trying to do, you know, that sounds like in the ballpark of where you need to be. What's your what do you eat? A lot of meat, or?
Yes. So I eat a ton of fish. So a lot of salmon, a lot of cod, a lot of red meat. So a lot of sort of lean steaks, fillets, sirloins, that kind of thing. A lot of chicken, a lot of lean pork tenderloin, stuff like that.
Yeah.
One of the great things about this time period for me is that I learned how to cook green vegetables in a way that I found enjoyable. And it turns out literally all they needed was bacon grease. And so you take a broccoli or a spinach or something that it's fine on its own. There's nothing wrong with it, but you add a little bit of bacon grease and all of a sudden, you know, not only does it taste good, but for me at this point, I can tolerate and need those fats. And so it's not a problem diet wise.
Right.
So that's been really good. And so it's a lot of that protein and then a lot of vegetables. And I've tried to cut out, I basically only eat, white sugar and things like that if I am particularly seeking out a dessert, right?
Like
that's one of the problems with the American diet, right? There's really nothing wrong with the sugar that's in cake. The problem is we took that sugar and we put it in our cereal.
That's a great point.
And like all these other things, right? So if you're going to say like, I'm going to have a couple of cookies tonight, there's nothing wrong with that if you sort of build it into your plan and all that kind of stuff. The problem is that we took that processed sugar and put it in everything else.
Yeah.
And so I avoid that for most of the day. And then if I'm going to avail myself to that, I do it intentionally.
Yeah. See, that's a great point. I intentionally eat very low carb. However, I've never been one of those people that's like, look, you got to have going back to release, you got to have a release. You have to know that on Sunday you're going to eat a pizza, you know,
and
but you do it intentionally. And the other problem is, you're so right about the sugar thing. The other problem is they've put sugar in everything, right? Like people think they're eating something that's not sugar. My dad's going through that right now. He's recovering from some problems with diabetes, and we were lecturing him at the house the other day. I said, listen, I was like, when you eat oatmeal, that's sugar. That's carbs. Right. That turns into sugar in your body. He's like, I don't understand. I'm like, it's sugar. He's like, I don't put any sugar on it. I'm like, you're not hearing me. But it's in everything. So, but I love your point. If you want a piece of chocolate cake, eat a damn piece of chocolate cake and do it intentionally and don't feel bad about it. Just don't have it in everything else you eat throughout the course of the day.
Exactly.
You know, or what I like to do is establish a cheat day. So I know like Saturday, I can eat whatever I want. And, you know, it's you do it intentionally. It's a great point. Going back to the work ethic thing, and I promise we're going to talk. We're talking with my good buddy, Josh Crawford from the Pegasus Institute. I want to get into the two topics that we were going to talk about today. But just going back to the work ethic thing, because I just think there's a lot of that missing in today's society. I was having a conversation with my best friend over the weekend. I was visiting him down in Arizona, and he was talking about his kids, and one of them's a millennial, and he was just like, what is going on with this generation that they can't cope? They can't figure out, you know, everything is somebody else's fault. There's no desire to dig in and do things autonomously. And I remember a similar story to what you had when I was a kid. My dad, I was about 12 or 13 years old, and my dad was managing a construction company, and they had a job about 20 miles from our house. And one day at lunchtime, he comes home, and this sounds weird, but I'm in school at home because my parents started a private Christian school, and it was in our home, and I'm there. My dad comes home at lunch break, and he says, I'm taking Leland to work with me. So I get in the truck with him. We go back to the work site. My dad lines up all his guys. Apparently, they had been being very lazy, lackadaisical, weren't watching what they were doing, making a lot of mistakes, and it irked him. So he lined them all up, and he said, listen, guys, he said, you guys are going home for the day. And he goes, since you guys are not capable of doing this job and taking this job seriously, I don't want to see your faces. My 12-year-old son and I are going to finish this job. We had a deadline by midnight. This thing had to be done. So he sent six guys home, and my dad and I finished laying the tile work for this community center that they were building. And I remember it was like close to the deadline because it was midnight deadline, and he's laying tile, sweat's pouring off his brow. I'm sitting there handing him stuff. And I was like, Dad, you know, why are we doing this? And he goes, he just stopped and he goes, because anything worth being done is worth being done right. And then he went back to working. And it was like that whole lesson was, and his guys, by the way, they straightened up after that because it embarrassed them. These are grown men. Because my dad goes, we get the job done. And my dad tells him the next day, he's like, me and my 12-year-old son got done what you guys couldn't get done in 3 days. We got it done in 7 hours. And that embarrassed them, and they straightened up after that. I think he had to fire like one or two of them, but the rest of them straightened up, and they got, you know, they started to do their thing right. But then there were a couple other times, like I remember one time I wanted a pair of Nike Airs back when those were like super popular in high school, you know, early 90s. And I always had a $20 budget for shoes, and which meant I was getting Walmart shoes, and I hated it. Zips or Zaps or whatever those things were. And my dad's like, okay, well, you have $20 for shoes, so if you can't get Nikes for that, what are you going to do about it? So I literally went to this restaurant that was next door to our house, and I said, can you give me a job? And they said, the only thing we have that needs to be done is cleaning the trash room where we take all the grease out from the burgers, which I'm just going to tell you right now, cleaning cooking grease from a fast food restaurant is one of the most disgusting things you'll ever do in your life. And I took that job, and I earned the money to get my Nikes, you know, and it was just like lessons like that that have grounded those ideals in our head, you know, from parents that actually had to roll up their sleeves and get dirty. You know, I think we're missing that in society today in a big way.
Absolutely. I think one of the major mistakes that people make is they either think that they have to be like David Goggins or Jocko Willink or that they can, or they can sit at home. They believe that life exists on the edges of the spectrum, right? And the reality is that the overwhelming majority of really hardworking people don't get up as early as Jocko Willink does to work out and all that kind of stuff. They don't run the ultra super duper marathons like David Goggins does. And that's okay, right? Like doing whatever it is that you do well and intentionally and with, you know, forethought and doing it to the best of your ability will get you to the place that you want to be in,
right?
Like you don't have to get up at 4:30 in the morning every morning. You have to get up whatever time it is that you get to work on time so that you're alert and aware and do whatever you need to do before you get there, kind of thing.
Right.
And then just once you're there, do whatever you have to do well, to your father's point, right? There's right. a lot of people, I don't know if this is generational or not, who I think that being at work means they're working.
Yeah,
right? Like as right. long as they're in the building,
right.
they're working.
Right.
And of course, that's not the case, right? And so it's about doing whatever it is that you do well. And there's honor in that, and there is something to be proud of in that. And I think not enough people do that. And in part, it's because they psych themselves out, right? Like, I can't possibly do what so-and-so does.
Right.
Well, of course, nobody's asking you to do what so-and-so does. We're asking you to be the best version of you.
Right, right. I love that. That's a great point. About the Breonna Taylor situation, Louisville was, by the time you're listening to this, it's Thursday. And so Wednesday night was a little bit tense. There was also two police officers shot.
Correct, yeah.
They're going to survive. They're going to recover, what I understand. So that's very good news. There's a couple things on this. One, it's clear to me that there were plans in place no matter what the decision was going to be, because obviously the grand jury indicted one Louisville police officer in the raid, in the death of Breonna
right.
Taylor. There were plans for at least some people to get violent regardless of what the outcome was. Because
right.
I saw a thing on Twitter last night, and again, it is Twitter, so I don't want to, you know, go down a road, but something about like a U-Haul that showed up with a bunch of shields for people, you know, it's like,
correct. Yeah.
There was an organized effort to get wild, so to speak. There's a couple things that I noticed in this. One, there's a lot more information that's come out in the Breonna Taylor case since the beginning of this. And that doesn't justify, in my opinion, what happened in her loss of life. I'm not saying that, but I do want to point out that a lot has come forward, and it does seem like that, thanks to the media and thanks to certain elements that want to foment chaos, there is not any concern about those new details. Like, people aren't looking at those new details and factoring that into their reaction to this. That being said, the indictment was interesting to me because the one indictment was not for what happened to Breonna Taylor. It was because
right.
the officer shot into another apartment.
Right.
And the thing that bothers me about this whole story is I firmly stand on the side of banning no-knock raids, except in the case where there's imminent danger to an individual or to other people. Because it puts the police in danger, it puts the suspect in danger, and it puts surrounding neighbors in danger. The problem here appears to be that the police were not necessarily following, they appeared to be, at least, and I want to be careful about this because I don't have all the details in front of me, but in some cases the police do things that we all consider to be wrong, but they're actually following procedure, let's just put it that way. And
mm-hmm.
so the anger needs to be directed at people who make the procedure, right?
Right.
And it feels like maybe this indictment was, well, this is the only thing we can charge for, but the indictment sort of admits why no-knock raids are a bad idea in the first place. You know, when you look at the details of the Breonna Taylor case, this entire thing could have been handled the next morning when somebody was leaving the house to go to work. You could have arrested with a warrant or searched with a warrant. You know, I don't understand why it has to be in the middle of the night, and especially in an apartment complex, you're shooting. You know, you understand what I'm getting at here? So it's like that indictment to me shows that the policy is wrong, because
right.
you can't be doing a no-knock raid in an apartment complex where there's other people, potentially children, sleeping next door, and bullets could, you know, rounds could go through those walls.
Right.
What am I wrong about here?
So I think there's a lot to criticize here. as a matter of policy. And I think as a matter of clarification, there are a couple of things I'll say. First, so the officers who ultimately entered Ms. Taylor's apartment were granted a no-knock exception for that warrant, but have said all along that they did knock, and the knock was undisputed, even by Ms. Taylor's boyfriend, who survived that night. What was contested is whether or not they announced themselves.
Okay.
Attorney General Cameron detailed yesterday, and the New York Times has a piece where they went and talked to a number of the neighbors in the area about this. An upstairs neighbor said that that individual did hear the officers announce themselves as well, and everyone else said that they did not hear an announcement. Not okay. that they heard the events and didn't hear an announcement, but that they just sort of didn't hear.
Okay.
And so the only sort of corroborating witness other than the law enforcement there that day says that the law enforcement did in fact knock and then did in fact announce.
Right.
One of the really troubling things about this night, though, is twofold. One, that our narcotics officers were not required to wear body cameras.
And right.
So there's not body camera footage from those officers that night. There's not footage until some of the patrol cars show up. And the officers were in plain clothes, which is problematic for a number of reasons. Right.
If
somebody says, knocks on their door, so says that they're police, and they come in and they're in tactical gear, your response is going to be very different, I think, than if somebody knocks on your door, comes in, and they're in jeans and a hoodie.
Right.
I think you and I have talked about this before. I'm not sure if it was in private or on the podcast, but I genuinely don't know what I would do if someone in boots, jeans, and a hoodie kicked in my door at 1 a.m. this morning.
I have a feeling I know what I would do, and it won't end well.
I mean,
it's like,
exactly.
Because I would be assuming I'm a law-abiding citizen, and because this is one thing that bothers me about this. LMPD has had multiple instances where they've raided the wrong house.
Right.
And if you're somebody who's not involved in anything nefarious and somebody's busting down your door at 3 o'clock in the morning, what do you think you're going to assume?
Right. Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I hope ends up being a part of the conversation here. This has been talked about basically one of two ways, either an example of systematic racism or as sort of a one-off, everything was justified, it's just tragic.
Right,
and I
right.
think there's a middle ground there.
Agreed.
That deserves to be talked about, that I believe that this was a true governance failure and is symptomatic of larger problems within our city.
Right.
We here at Pegasus have been talking about this for the better part of 3 or 4 years now, that our police department is getting smaller, and so caseloads and workloads are getting bigger. Our department has gotten much younger because more experienced officers have gone elsewhere, and
yep.
so we've had to try to recruit our way to making up for that and still haven't been able to make up for it. So we've got a very young department, a very a shrinking department. We also have had a number of high-profile incidences of either outright corruption or misbehavior that have plagued the department. And we have had, just since I have been in Kentucky, a number of no confidence votes in our former chief, both from the local Fraternal Order of Police and from Metro Council.
Right.
So you've got sort of a toxic culture that emanates from the top, and then you've got a young and shrinking department
yeah.
that is coming into that culture and expected to weather it. And so the question I would ask our elected officials is, what did you expect to happen?
Right.
What did you think was going to happen? And obviously, it's not necessarily this specific instance, but our guys on the street are not the reason this happened. A department culture and policies that have been put in place are
right.
why we found ourselves at this place. I mean, three of the four deadliest years in our city's history has been in the last 5 years.
Right.
You know, we should not be particularly surprised by the way things have unraveled.
Yeah.
And that's not a commentary on the average officer who is walking a beat or in a patrol car or just trying to do their job. That's a commentary on leadership and elected officials.
Agreed. And agreed on the stuff that's just been stewing. And it's the issue is has got to be policy. You know, I was taken aback when Rand Paul was attacked in Washington, D.C. by people chanting, "Say her name." And I was like, he's the guy who authored the bill that has her name in it. You know, that's part of the problem.
Breonna Taylor Act.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem here is that, as you said, we have people on one side or the other, as opposed to recognizing the real middle here. And normally I'm not a middle of the road guy. I have strong opinions, but I have a strong opinion that there's an answer in the middle here. You know, it's like, not every time an officer uses force, it's not necessarily driven by racism, but it may be driven by a whole lot of things stewing under the scenes that you just mentioned that create a toxic situation that leads to bad policy. You know, and that's the conversation we need to be having around America. And we need to acknowledge that, you know, our friends, especially in the African-American community, are correct in at least they see and they feel and they perceive this thing this way. And I'm like, that's legitimate. But we also need to recognize that the vast majority of cops don't get up and think, I'm going to go oppress some people in a poor part of town today. It's not how they operate. But we do have a problem where there's a culture of not necessarily addressing big issues when they arise. I think that's part of the problem with what's gone on here in this city for so long is just the leadership is so concerned about bad news getting out that they cover it up. This is the most non-transparent administration I've ever seen. I mean, it's pathetic. And I think it's led to this. And so it becomes difficult to have conversations. And the media doesn't help because the mainstream media has just been fomenting this. And one of the reasons why some of, like, I saw there was an article in WDRB, and they were like, right-wing news spreads scary stories about Antifa. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Look at what's happening in Portland. You know, I mean, these aren't scary stories. These are happening. They're happening. You know, so... they run that story like right after two officers get shot in this melee last night. So it's, I don't know, it's difficult to weed through and find those solutions. And I think, first of all, I stand with the idea of criminal justice reform. That's the other part of this is we have more people in prison in America per capita than China does. We have systemic problems in our justice system. It's not necessarily, as you said, the beat cops. You know, it has to do, I think, with training and how we're training. I think it has to do with leadership, and I think it has to do with essentially a private prison system that's happy to keep incarcerating people.
Yeah, I think there's a lot here. I think, and quite frankly, I don't think it's just a criminal justice question.
Right.
I think that criminal justice and policing perhaps play an outsized role in this conversation.
Sure.
But there are other systems of government that are sort of
failing,
close to, if not equally responsible for sort of why we are where we are in terms of economic investment and education opportunities and achievement gaps and things like that, that need to equally be addressed, that are sort of front end inputs as opposed to back end inputs.
Don't you think the problem with why we can't discuss those solutions is because of the red versus blue war that's going on right now? I mean, I honestly believe that the Republican and the Democrat Party exist for the sole purpose of opposing each other.
Yeah, and that's true, right? Because political parties at the end of the day are basically marketing firms, right? Like, we exist to make our side look better, and they exist to make their side look better.
Right.
But I do believe that the political process lends itself to policymaking, right? And we are perhaps more polarized than we've ever been. And there are, you know, problems that we are dealing with that feel and seem unique. But I was having a conversation with a friend of mine the other day, who is a Christian, whose father was a Christian, but grew up in the rural South, and he's a white man. His father was a white man, and they were talking about at a men's meeting within my friend's adult lifetime, and they were supporting a black preacher in a congregation across town, and they were they would occasionally have the preachers that they support come and sort of do a sermon at the church kind of thing, and a debate erupted over whether or not they were going to have this black preacher come and deliver a sermon at this white, predominantly white, exclusively white, I think, congregation. And there was a segment of men there who wanted nothing to do with it, didn't want this gentleman to come, were happy to support the work that he was doing in his community, but didn't want him to come and preach to their folks.
Wow.
And it hit ahead at one point where somebody basically asked the question that, would you rather your daughter marry a white man who wasn't a Christian or a black man who was? And this white man, sort of without batting an eye, said, I would rather she marry a white man who wasn't a Christian than a black man who was.
Wow.
And it was like this real wake-up moment for the rest of the congregation of, like, that is a remarkably un-Christian position, right?
Right.
And so,
as well as remarkably racist.
Right, exactly. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, this was 30, 40 years ago.
Right.
And we're in a bad spot right now, but I don't believe in my core that we are in that spot
right
anymore.
Right. I agree with that.
And
I agree with that statement.
And so as difficult as things may seem right now, that doesn't mean that we cannot find solutions, that we cannot progress the way that we need to. It means we have to navigate things differently. And frankly, it falls to, I think, organizations like mine to wade into these spaces and say, hey, I know what's going on out here looks really bad, but here's what we can do about it. I am frankly sick of the tone and tenor that a lot of
yeah.
folks are taking, that we are sort of at the that we are at this point of no return, that things have never been this bad, et cetera, et cetera. And by a lot of metrics, things are frankly better than they've ever been. We've got problems.
Right.
But our attitude should be like, okay, we've got problems. We're Americans. Let's fix those problems.
I agree. I think whenever things don't make sense, right, like what makes sense to me is the idea of criminal justice reform and fixing these things that you've pointed out, disparities, equality of opportunity, not outcomes, but opportunity, fixing the achievement gaps in schools. These things are all real problems that must be addressed. It doesn't matter whether you're Republican or Democrat. They must be addressed. We're not that far removed. There are people alive today who could not eat and drink at the same restaurant you and I did. And
right.
we're not that far removed from it. I agree with you. We're not in that place now, but we're not that far removed from it. We have to address those issues. But when things don't make sense, like the Antifa stuff, and the violence and shooting two officers last night and things like that, when things don't make sense, I always look at who profits. Who profits? Mm-hmm. You know, and I know the media profits because of clicks. And I know the two political parties profit because, as you, I think that what you said earlier was pretty profound. The political parties are marketing arms of ideologies. That's a great way to look at it, because I think that's really what's happening. And so the people that profit, because here's the deal, man. I live in a mixed neighborhood. I don't even think about it. I mean, honestly, I would say the houses around me, I don't even know. I mean, like, but it's just a mixed neighborhood, and it's wonderful. Right. My neighbors are wonderful. We're friends. We hang out in the street and talk. We talk about each other's yard work. You know, it's wonderful.
Right.
Average Americans get along. We're not throwing rocks at each other's houses. We're borrowing sugar from each other. You know what I mean? That's average
right.
America, right? But as soon as those political signs go up in the yard, bam, we're red or blue. You know what I mean? And so
right.
that to me is the biggest hindrance to this. I'm glad there's organizations like yours that are trying to cut through that in a nonpartisan way and say, look, here's the solution to the policy issue. That's what we need to be talking about in America.
Well, and I think the other thing that we need to talk about is the thing that you just said, the like we're neighborly and we're borrowing cups of sugar and then political signs go up and all of a sudden we can't be friends. We need to call that what it is, which is pathetic.
Right.
I think we're going to talk about this in a minute, but the takeaway that Americans should have from Ruth Bader Ginsburg's life is multifold. But one of the big ones is the relationship that she had with Justice Scalia.
Yes.
They were remarkably close friends. I mean, personal friends, spent time together, went on trips together, would go to the opera together, you know, their family were friends, all these kinds of things, right? Those are the two individuals who, for the better part of 30 years, defined judicial philosophy on the two sides of this debate in this country.
Right.
I mean, they were spot one and spot one on their respective sides for defining what it meant to be a conservative jurist or a liberal jurist.
Right.
If Jim the barber and Bill the plumber can't get along because one of them votes for Obama and one of them votes for Trump,
right.
That is pathetic.
Yes.
If the two people who are defining what it means to believe those things at the highest level can get along,
right.
You can get along with your neighbor even though they vote differently than
That's
you.
A really good point. Of course, I don't put political signs in my yard for that reason. That is a great point. And I think, you know, I have friends on all sides of the political spectrum, and I love vigorous debates. I won't engage with those friends who get, like, if they're not willing to talk policy. I told one friend the other day, I said, look, I'm not going to sit here and debate Trump's character, because you can tell me all the bad things about Trump's character, and I can tell you all the bad things about Biden's character, and we're just going to go around and around about who has the worst guy. And I said, that's not the point. If you want to debate policy, should we have a progressive tax code, or should we have a flat tax or a fair tax? Should everybody get free health care, or should we have to pay something, and should we encourage free markets to fix the health care system? You know, should we have a strong, secure border, and how should we reform? Let's debate those policies all day long, and I'll do that. I don't care what your political position is. But the minute you start calling names, or you start impugning my character because of who I voted for in the last election, I'm done with you. Because you can't, we can't boil every, I can't boil, if you voted for Biden or if you voted for Obama, I can't boil everything about you and what you think down to that one vote. That's asinine.
Right.
I voted for Trump in 2016. I desperately want to vote libertarian in 2020, but I don't even know if that's a wise decision given what's possibly at stake. But I you know, how I voted, Trump was not my guy in 2016.
Right.
He was how many guys ran? How many candidates did we have? Was it 15?
16, I think. 16. Yeah.
He was choice 15. He was right before Kasich. That's where he was for me.
Right.
Right? So don't you dare boil my politics down to he's a Trump supporter. That ain't it at all. You know what I mean?
Right.
And the same thing with, she's an Obama supporter. What do you know about what that person really thinks? Nothing unless you engage. Right. You know? So, all right. Well, that's a great segue. Let's talk about the Supreme Court. This is your forte. You're a law guy. You've studied the Supreme Court. We've had you on about the Supreme Court before. Let me start with the elephant in the room. Is Trump right to make a nomination this close to an election?
He certainly constitutionally has the right to and the ability to. The political ramifications of that, I don't think we know at this point, but it's certainly within his constitutional purview to do so. And I think some folks are somewhat misrepresenting what Senator McConnell said the last time around with the Scalia seat. McConnell's position at the time was that it is remarkably rare when the president and the Senate are of different parties for an election year nominee to be confirmed. And when the Senate and the president are of the same political party, it's pretty standard practice for the nominee to be confirmed. And that's bore out over history. Now, there were some senators on both sides of the aisle who overstated that. And so there are some senators who are dealing with quotes now that look quite hypocritical.
Right.
Because they did say, no, you shouldn't confirm a Supreme Court nominee in an election year. But Trump certainly has the ability to and the right to make that appointment, certainly to put a nominee forward. And there is time to thoroughly vet and if the Senate so chooses, confirm a nominee. But I do think there's a lot of people on both sides who have a decent amount of egg on their face.
Yeah.
Because they so viscerally and emotionally supported one position four short years ago.
Yeah.
And have now gone as far in the other direction as possible.
Yeah, I think the key difference between, in terms of what McConnell was talking about, and the key difference between the two situations, one, you had opposite parties in the White House and the Senate. The other is that President Obama was leaving office for good. He was right. Not up for re-election. He was leaving office for good, which meant that the country was going to decide whether we wanted a Republican or a Democrat in that office. And so the what I took from what McConnell said was, in a situation like this where you have a guy that's leaving and he's gone, and you have the opposite party in control of the Senate, then it's probably prudent to wait until the next guy comes in and let him have his choice. This is an entirely different situation where you have a president who's finishing up his first term. You have a long history of Americans not changing horses midstream and giving a president a second term. We don't know that that's going to happen, but it's pretty normal. And we have the Republicans in control of the Senate. It's a very different situation. It's apples to oranges. And I know that my liberal friends hearing this are going to do everything they can to concoct that now I'm a hypocrite. But that's the facts. Now, the political ramifications, I guess part of me is like, I don't know. Part of me is like, wouldn't it be smarter to fire up your base with this and say, I need to be reelected because, you know, because it seems like it's going to work the opposite direction. You know, it seems like it's just going to piss the Democrats off and they're going to be more fired up if you're worried about left versus right. I don't know. I'm not a prognosticator of those things, but.
Yeah, I think the calculation there is that it would actually be difficult to fire up the left more than they are currently.
That's a good point.
And so there's little risk there.
Right, that's a good point.
Republican voters have a track record of caring about the Supreme Court.
Right.
I can't recall the number off the top of my head, but a significant number of Republicans who decided in the last weeks of the election to vote for Donald Trump said they did so because of that Supreme Court seat. And so it is, there is potential to sort of fire up some folks with that. But the other calculation there is right, is that none of it may matter and you may not get reelected. And do you want to give Joe Biden the opportunity to fill that seat, which I think no matter what would shift the court to the right. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was probably the second most liberal justice on the court at the time of her death. Justice Breyer probably being the only one who was slightly more liberal. And so as long as Republicans maintain control of the Senate, which it's appearing, again, not to make a prediction or prognostication, that it's looking more and more like will be the case, even a Joe Biden nominee would probably be a bit more moderate in order to successfully achieve confirmation.
My concern, though, from a purely, and I'm this is going to sound like a partisan argument, but it's not. It's a policy argument. If Biden gets elected, I think one of the first priorities he's going to have is to come after gun rights. And I'm not a one-issue voter, but that's a pretty damn big issue for me. And I'm almost like, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't want to make a prediction. There's a really good chance Biden wins this election.
Right.
I would, and then let's look at it from the conservative point of view. If Biden wins the election and he gets to replace Ginsburg, it's really a wash, right? Because it's still a 5-4 court, theoretically, even though Justice Roberts seems to be more left than right lately. But if he gets, if Trump goes ahead and selects and replaces, now we have a 6-3 court, theoretically, which would require, which would be a buffer against if one of the other aged conservative justices has to leave. So from a conservative standpoint, perhaps it's smarter in terms of firing up voters to do that. I don't know.
Right.
I don't really care about the political party's fare here, but I do care about the court and I do care about the direction. And I don't want quote unquote conservative justices. Don't get me wrong. I want justices that interpret the Constitution as it is written. I do not want activist judges. I don't want right wing activist judges, and I don't want left wing activist judges. I want judges who look at the law and say, this is what it means. That's what I want. But I think when you look at the law and say, this is what it means, Second Amendment rights end up being protected. That's what's very important to me.
Well, I'm really glad to hear you say that, Leland, because there is this growing intellectual movement on the right to try to support sort of conservative activism in our courts. And I think it ultimately is dangerous and folly for our side to pursue that. But there is this sort of growing belief that what we actually need is not textualist or originalist, but conservative activist. And I couldn't reject that more. And to your point about what a replacement looks like, I actually prefer a Ruth Bader Ginsburg type to a Anthony Kennedy, David Souter, Sandra Day O'Connor type. Justice Ginsburg was knowable in her approach to the law. And sometimes that made for really strange bedfellows and decisions.
Yes.
There are a number of 5-4 decisions that are, you know, Thomas, Scalia, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Alito, and then the other 4 justices in dissent. And so when Justice Ginsburg, although very much sort of a Lockean liberal in her approach to rights, not that they pre-existed government, but that they were sort of broader than what was encompassed in the Constitution, that she was a substantive due process person, that she was a living constitutionalist, had a philosophy and stuck to that philosophy, and that philosophy was knowable.
Right.
It's these squishy middle types that are susceptible to the politics of the moment.
Like Roberts?
that I actually think lead to really bad case law and really bad decisions that ultimately hurt us down the line more than the liberals typically do.
Yeah.
And so I kind of appreciate and have an appreciation, although I very frequently disagreed with her analysis and ultimate decision, the way that someone like Ruth Bader Ginsburg approached the law.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's my problem with Justice Roberts, because his decisions seem all over the place. There's not a consistency to them. And I think it's probably why, I guess, everybody wants one more quote unquote conservative activist judge. Although I don't see Gorsuch as a conservative activist judge. I think President Trump, probably one of the great things he's done is he's picked pretty good justices.
Oh yeah.
Gorsuch and Kavanaugh are both, I think, very textualist.
Oh yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I just, because of the circles I find myself in sometimes, I know among the activist groups and among some academics on the right, legal academics in particular, there is this push for a sort of more activist judiciary.
There's a desire, there's a hard desire to overturn Roe versus Wade. And that is, as much as I support life, don't get me wrong, I do. I would love to see that overturned. I think that was the wrong decision that was made by the court. But I also think that's somewhat of an activist position at this point.
Well, and in truth, we are, frankly, I don't think one justice away from overturning Roe v. Wade.
Right. No, not at all.
I think on the court right now, you have maybe 2 votes to overturn Roe v. Wade, and it's Thomas and Alito.
Right.
I don't think Gorsuch would do it. I don't think Kavanaugh would do it. I don't think Roberts would do it. And so let's say that Ginsburg's replacement is an Amy Coney Barrett, who may also be a vote in that direction.
Now you only have 3.
You're looking at a 6-3 case, but you're looking at it the wrong direction.
Yeah, that's interesting. Let's talk about packing the court. this is the threat from the Democrats. I was noticing on Twitter or on Facebook the other day, and a lot of people didn't know. I made this comment. I said that packing the court inherently makes it political. Because you essentially, well, I just made that statement and people mistook what they thought I meant that President Trump would be packing the court by picking a judge before, you know,
gotcha.
Now. And I was like, I had to go back and explain. I was like, people, do you understand what packing the court means? It's a liberal philosophy that when we don't have enough justices on our side, we go get more justices and we add justices. So we make it a 13 justice Supreme Court instead of 9. And that way we can pack the court because we'll be in charge and we get to pick the other new judges. And that will change the leaderboard, so to speak, on activist judges. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg was correct on this. Last year, she argued that's a terrible idea because it will make the court inherently political. It's whenever one side gets in, they just add more justices so that their side gets to pick. And now you have a court that swings wildly with the political pendulum, which is a very terrible idea for the law. That's essentially what Ginsburg said. So this would be a terrible idea. How can they even do that? Like if Democrats get power, let's say they win the Senate, they got the House, they got the presidency, can they pack the court, meaning add more justices to the court in order to make it go out their side?
Yeah, so there is no constitutional limitation on Supreme Court justices. Article 3 of the Constitution doesn't say 9. We haven't always had 9. FDR had floated the idea of packing the court before, and the sort of history there is that it was so unpopular that he ended up reversing his position on it. But there are many historians who believe that he was never serious about the question of packing the court, but he wanted to get the court in line. And he was able to get the court in line, so to speak. And his New Deal policies went from being rejected 5-4 to being upheld 5-4.
Huh.
And so it wouldn't shock me if the same kind of thing was going on now. And there was an attempt to sort of pressure the court one way or the other. I think we have far fewer justices on the court today than certainly 10 or 20 years ago who would be likely to succumb to that kind of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that it would matter much. But what I think Senate Democrats need is a Supreme Court historian on staff. And what I mean by that is, they never seem to quite grasp the long-term ramifications of the things that they do,
right?
You have all these folks coming to the floor railing against the process now and the lack of collegiality in the process, and I wish that somebody would just sit them down and play them the Bork and Thomas hearings and say, you all opened this can of worms. And then when they talk about packing the court, I wish that somebody would sit them down and show the video of Senator McConnell saying that Harry Reid and the Democrats are going to regret moving away from the filibuster to simple majorities on judicial nominations.
Right.
Because they did that. And then obviously both Gorsuch and Kavanaugh would not have met a 60 vote threshold to get onto the court. And so let's say you pack the court. You may win the day. But don't be surprised if somewhere down the line, 20, 30 years from now, a 13-justice court has 8, 9, 10 right-of-center judges on it.
Yeah.
And now you've got such an overwhelming majority, you can do whatever you want.
Right.
This is the problem with attempts like this to sort of stick your finger in the hole from the leak because the liberals have controlled the court for so long. They're constantly trying to plug these holes and make sure that they continue to do so. But whenever you change processes or you change numbers on the court or things like that, one day you will turn around and those circumstances will no longer favor you.
Well, the other thing, though, the more serious and present danger to this, though, I think is that issue of making it inherently political by saying we're going to pick four more justices because that'll make it go our way. You've essentially ended what the point of the court is in the first place. I mean, the point of the court is to stop one or the other or anybody in power politically from running roughshod over rights. That's what the point of the court is. It is a check and balance. If you remove its ability to check the parties in power, you've lost what the point of the court is, and we shouldn't even have a court to begin with. That's the scariest part to me, is that along the way to that 30 years from now, all the abuses that will take place because the court became political. I think largely right now, the court is fairly non-political. I know my left-wing friends will try to argue the opposite, but I think it's been a pretty non-political court over the last few years, and I would like to keep it that way.
This is pretty high on my list of things I would ask James Madison about if given the opportunity, because Madison obviously cared deeply about checks and balances and about factions.
Right.
And Madison believed that the branches of government would inherently be a check on one another, right? That the executive would have things inherent to the executive that would always be at odds with the legislature.
Right.
And the legislative branch would have inherent things that made about it being the legislature and would always be in conflict with the executive and the judiciary and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
I do wonder in the age that we're in, where political party seems to dominate more than, branch of government.
Right.
And it hasn't always been that way, right? For a long time in the country, region mattered more. Southern Democrats and Southern Republicans in the Senate had far more in common than Southern Republicans and Northern Republicans.
Right.
You know, it was regional.
Right.
And so right now we're in this period where partisanship seems to be the ties that bind us in politics. And so the check that's on that is not quite what it otherwise would be. And so the thought process there, I think, is that the president appoints a nominee to the Supreme Court who shares his or her values when it comes to interpreting the Constitution. And then the Senate would evaluate that individual on their merits for the position. And if they passed sort of a merits-based, an objective merits-based analysis, they'd be confirmed for the court.
Right.
But of course, that can of worms was opened fully in 1987.
Yeah.
And we haven't looked back. Yeah. I would love, truthfully, to get to a point where that wasn't the case. I just don't know that we are anywhere close to getting back to that place. And so if we're going to treat Supreme Court or judicial nominations like we would any other matter of policymaking, then that's sort of where we are. And so if the Democrats want to try to play that hand, and I do think it would make the court much, much more political, they're going to have to deal with the political ramifications of trying to play that hand. And I don't think that the American people want that.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. All right. Wow. We've done a full hour here. So I could go on for more and more hours, but I always appreciate you guys. Pegasus Institute. Tell people where they can find your info, because you're doing an awful lot of work to keep people informed and move policy forward.
I appreciate that, Leland. So PegasusKentucky.org. Kentucky is spelled all the way out. We're on Twitter, Facebook, all that kind of stuff, but everything can be found through the website. Our blog is there. Podcasts are there. And then on the Facebook and Twitter, we'll share not only our own stuff, but other stuff that we think might be of interest to folks who are interested in policy.
Awesome. All right. We'll go get in the gym, lift some weights, buddy.
Will do.
All right. Thanks for popping on with us.
All right. Thanks, Leland.
All right. Josh Crawford from the Pegasus Institute. Great dude. Wow. We went like an hour on that. Interesting stuff. I could have gone on for several more, but I don't have time for that. And you don't have time for that. And Josh didn't have time for that. So I got an estimate coming in the house. I got a contractor getting ready to come in. So there you go. Hey, listen, thanks for listening. You can find us on all the places podcasts can be found. iHeartRadio's app, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts. All you got to do is just type in the search bar, The Disruption Zone, and boom, there you go. All right. Thanks for listening. Again, you can find me on Twitter. It's at Leland Show and at Zone Disruption, at Great Lelando on Instagram, and at The Disruption Zone on Instagram, and of course, Facebook, Leland Conway as well. Thanks to the folks at Dynamics Productions for their help, and JP Web Design as well. That's it for me. I am Leland Conway. Thanks for listening to The Disruption Zone.